find a balance between giving us adequate information and our ability to can still properly remember where we started by the time we finish. Meaning, therefore, how do we lift out critical and strategic information, and not talk to everything and anything, so that we're able to focus on those areas that seek to enable us to have a sense of where we come from, where we are, where we intend to go, and how we intend to reach there, so that at the end we have a proper picture of how we seek to be in a different environment from where we come from. I'm just raising this, not being sure of my own capacity to think through all these slides as I try to quickly go through them. But we're in your hands nonetheless.
Say, we'll do our best to try and summarize in where it is possible for us to do so. To try and accommodate the issue that the Honourable Chair has spoken about.
But the point I'm saying is that in the midst of all this information, let us still try and lift out the strategic area so that we don't focus on everything, but we're able to zoom in on those areas that are indeed strategic and relevant for the purposes of where we come from.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Chair. I'll ask you that we start off, I think, on slide number 2 or 3 on the termination support, yes. Okay. Look, Chair, first and foremost, it would be remembered that we entered into a termination support period for 12 months, within which the present the service provider was to finalize all outstanding deliverables from the PPP and hand over the ICT environment back to the department, which included, of course, the institutional memory issues in terms of information, licenses, and contracts, and so on. Now, at the other time when we had appeared before Parliament, the parliamentary committees, we had indicated that we had finalized an ICT strategy in terms of articulating the future operating model. We had also looked at a combination of multi-vendor and in-house resources for ICT services. We had appointed PwC as a transaction advisor to develop specifications for tenders that we published, and that the tenders would address the ICT run services, basically operations and build services systems development. And each tenders were to be issued to the market to appoint service providers, and PwC was to assist with the process of the service agreements. Now, that's what we had articulated before parliamentary committees. Now, we're at a stage where we have taken review of our situation, and in so doing, strategic emergent factors are beginning to have begun to crop up, and that's what this part of the presentation in terms of the review and how that review impacts on the original strategic question or original intention. So that's what this part of the presentation deals with. And in this regard, I would ask our acting CIO, Mr. Sekerson, to just take us through this before I come onto the other issues.
Good morning, Chairpersons and Honourable Members. My name is Vikas Sekerson. I'm the acting CIO at the Department of Labour. See, this slide speaks to the review of the original intention that the department had. And the first step was then to define, to understand the business requirements of the organization and to define it. The next step was to develop an ICT strategy based on the business requirements and to then identify the ICT services required to support the business requirements. So then the following step would be to draft the tender specifications, which would go out to market through the publishing of tenders in open media, and then to appoint multiple service providers. As part of the strategy as well was to develop an internal ICT structure so that the department can capacitate itself and appoint internal resources. So there are two steps in terms of strategy, a multi-vendor environment plus an in-house capability. Now if we break that down a bit further, the original intent was to develop the ICT strategy and move towards a future ICT landscape. And in order to do that, there was PwC appointed as a transaction advisor, there were tender specs, there were ICT service towers that were defined so that all areas of ICT could be covered, and the services would be provided through a multi-vendor and internal resource capacitation. However, there were factors that influenced the strategy, and these were the compliance with the CETA Act, the budget that has been allocated to the Department of Labor, and Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act. And this then deviated slightly from the original intention of the ICT strategy to where we are currently with 3 months remaining, and the department then just needs to basically stabilize the current ICT environment. So if we look at the strategy revision factors, what are those factors that slightly deviated the strategy? The first one was the CETA compliance, and that base high level indicates that the CETA legislation requires that government departments need to acquire certain services from or through CETA, and there are mandatory services and non-mandatory services. The next one was the budget. The department has a limited budget in terms of information and communications technology, and we had to prioritize which strategic intentions or operational services could be pursued going forward. And lastly was the Labor Relations Act, Section 197, which needed to be factored in. And this was to determine if the resources currently providing the services through the company, through the ITEEE partner, which is EOH, had to be taken over by the Department of Labor. So in looking at this, we looked at what are the key risks in terms of the ICT environment moving forward for the department. And the first one was that there were no funds available to fully fund the ICT strategy. So we have to rationalize the current funding and prioritize those areas that we feel are critical. There is insufficient time for the transition period. So the take-on of resources through Section 197, if that was the route we were going to go, there wasn't sufficient time for that. There was no time for adequate handover. And I'm talking to the mitigation of this as well. The mitigation for that was that if we take over resources, there would be no need for a handover as the resources come with the intellectual property of the current environment. And there was non-existence of an IT continuity plan post the termination support period. Again, this would be addressed through the resources that were being taken over, as well as to ask the State Information Technology Agency, CETA, to assist as a further contingency. In looking at the options available to the department in addressing its ICT requirements, there were four options that were looked at. And the first one was a combination of the Section 197 resources, bringing in resources internally, as well as providing services through CETA. It was for CETA to take on IT services with the current resources. It was to appoint CETA as a full IT service provider and to take on the current resources through Section 197. Jefferson, I'm going to skip through the details and go directly to the options that the key option that we looked at, and that was the review of Section 197 option. In terms of Section 197, we looked at our employee relations and legal services concluded that Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act is applicable to this case. We sought senior counsel advice, which also agreed and cited case law to support the opinion. The company that we have, the Triple P agreement with EOH, also confirmed that their legal advice supports the conclusion that Section 197 is applicable. In terms of Section 197, neither us nor the service provider can cherry-pick the resources that they want. We have to take over the leave accruals and pension funds. That has to be taken over to the department. And the terms and conditions of employment of each employee must remain substantially the same. So we cannot change their current salaries or the current leave requirements, etc. So in looking at these options, we were mandated through Section 197 to take over the resources that are currently providing the ICT services. And we must highlight that this is the most complex and time-consuming option, which has the potential to become protracted. In terms of taking over the resources, we looked at how we're going to do that. And we've got a list of resources from the service provider.
Just a minute. I see that when we were in Pretoria, you clarified that EOH is a company that is currently providing services to the department. But if you say EOH resources, what do you mean? Can you just unpack that, because you keep on referring to EOH resources.
Okay. The correctly, like you say, EOH is the partner that is providing the termination support to the Department of Labor for the ICT services. The resources that I refer to are the people from EOH who are providing the services to the department. So it's the individuals in
all right. Okay.
Okay. We're looking at a takeover in a three-phase approach. The first one is to take over the management layer, because I think everyone's aware that the department is very low on internal capacity in terms of ICT. The second phase is to take over the critical staff, the ICT critical staff, from the service provider, and then to take over the remaining staff as part of phase three. In looking at Section 197, then we looked at the risks, and these are some of the key risks that we've identified and the mitigation that we are applying to that. The first one is that there is a delay in implementing the Labor Relations Act Section 197 that may affect the transfer of the employees. And in order to mitigate that, we have set up a dedicated human resource management team to manage the Section 197 process. The second key risk is that there's inadequate and insufficient implementation that might result in poor planning and possible litigations post the process. And in order to mitigate that, we've got legal services, employee relations, human resources, and a full team addressing this so that we don't falter in terms of taking over the resources through Section 197. And lastly, the third key risk is that there's insufficient budget to implement the Section 197 that is taking over the resources. And in this regard, the department is rationalizing current funding towards prioritizing ICT continuity, and also to share the costs between the two funds, which is the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the Compensation Fund for ICT services. In terms of timelines, we have finished August, and in August we've already looked at the service towers that we need to take on. We started with the process of mapping the resources to the departmental structure. We're looking at satisfying the regulatory requirements in terms of Section 197. And in the coming 3 months, September, October, November, we're looking at taking over the staff, the change management that will be required to address the staff concerns, for example, communication, things like that. And then in September, to take on the management layer that was the first phase that we identified. In October, we're looking at taking over the critical resources, and that will be assisted through the new management layer that we have taken on, then taking on the resources themselves, and then towards the end of the month, beginning of November, to take on the remaining resources. In November, we're looking at concluding all the outstanding items and closing out the termination support period. Now, if we look at the implications of what is happening, we have put together a dedicated human resource team to manage the process so that everything is being addressed from a human resource perspective, as well as from all the other areas, whether it's finance, it's legal, it's employee relations. There's a full-time team addressing these matters. There's continuous risk monitoring and management, so risk is on the team as well, and monitoring the risks, identifying new risks, and looking for mitigation that needs to take place. We needed to terminate the services of PwC because the emergent strategy indicates that they would not be required any further, and we will discuss it a bit, in a few slides forward. At this current stage, we will focus solely on taking over of the IT staff from the service provider and look only at IT continuity post-November. There's going to be no tenders that will be issued to market because most of the services will be provided in-house through the take-on of the resources. We will continue to liaise with CETA for additional requirements and additional requirements where there are service gaps that we are not getting all the services through the staff take-on. We have stopped all current appointments in terms of ICT in the department because the take-on would then fill the structure that has been approved. One key implication that's going to happen is that there's going to be an increased unfunded financial burden on the department and the two funds, UIF and Compensation Fund, in terms of the compensation of employees because of the take-on of resources. So we're looking at the services that we require as the Department of Labor that we need to take on the resources for. And we've defined them as operational services, and those are the services that are highlighted in green. I'm not going to go through that in detail. But also the non-essential services. So there were employees of the service provider who were providing these non-essential services for the PPP and in support of the IT service employees. So those are services like finance, legal services, business development, which already the department has most of these already in the structure. In terms of costing, if we look at a worst-case scenario where we have to take over all the resources that are currently providing the services, that means the operational services and the non-essential services, the worst-case scenario would be 12.3 million per month in terms of resources only. In terms of operational services that we required, and we've broken down into what we require, it would cost us 8.5 million per month. In doing this, we have realized that also, should this not happen, what would be our contingency plan? And if we take over Section 197 successfully by November 2013, then we have CETA to assist with the service gaps that we have identified, and those are things like infrastructure, service desks, things like that. If it's protracted, Section 197 is protracted and delayed, then we will ask CETA to assist, try and assist with the full range of operational services. CETA has already completed a due diligence, and they're finalizing the pricing in terms of how the costing that would be effective for these services. I think come to the last two slides. The current status and progress is we've had continuous stakeholder engagements with some of the key stakeholders that we believe are involved in this, and that is National Treasury in terms of funding. We've spoken to DPSA in terms of Section 197 structures. We've spoken to SARS to assist us in terms of technical resources to assist with the process. We are continuously engaging with CETA and, of course, EOH as the service provider. Just in terms of general, I indicated we are monitoring the risks weekly and updating the register and mitigating it. There's a full team that is been set up and mapping the resources. We've had to terminate the PwC contract, and CETA is engaged in proposals to serve as a contingency plan if required. In terms of Section 197, we've developed a position paper which has been finalized. That position paper basically puts forward the Department of Labor's position on how Section 197 is to be applied. Our view is that we need to take over the current operational staff providing the services. The EOH position is for the department to take over all the staff. We have an establishment, an approved establishment of 131. If we have to take over all the staff, there would be in excess of 200 resources that we'd need to take over. One of the concerns that has been raised is that some of the staff that we need to take over currently on salaries higher than government-approved salaries. One of the key risks that we face is that if the agreement is not reached by 30th November of this year, the department becomes responsible for all the employees from 1st of December 2013 and needs to address that. And any retrenchments or severances that take place post-November would be at the department cost, but for up to a year, the service provider, which is EOH, would also be liable if they didn't commit to all the requirements. I'd then like to hand over back to the DG.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. I certainly do think that some of these questions that we have just presented before you, they certainly do raise a whole range of different questions that we would have to concern ourselves about, and we have had to look at some of these particular issues in terms of what do these emergent factors, for instance, mean. I think some of the issues we have clarified. The issue of the strategy is there. The question of governance structures is being put in place, and in-house resourcing is being which are part of the strategy outlook of the department. Those things are being undertaken, and of course most of them are dependent on the availability of funds to be able to fully roll them out. The critical question, though, is whether or not is the department going to go out on tender, and the answer is that we are not going to go out on tender, which is contrary to what we had said before. And we're not going to go out on tender for key reasons. One is, of course, the budgetary constraints as they've been outlined, and, of course, the other one is the question of the Labor Relations Act in terms of Section 197. And let me just unpack a little bit on this one. Mr. Sackerson says some of the resource base, if taken over from the side of EOH, for example, they are outside the alignment of the government salary structure. At the top, just to give you a hint, at the top, four of these individuals are at the salaries of premiers. Below that, you also have 12 individuals that are at the salary levels of DGs. And 22 of these individuals are at salary levels of chief directors. Just an example, just about the top. And of course, if you were to take the pyramid all the way down, you find all these kinds of misalignments and so forth. So Section 197 has got huge implications for us from, yes, a financial point of view, but also from a structural point of view in terms of how we will have to deal with it. Now, the other question is whether or not the stopping PwC does it construe, for instance, wasteful expenditure and so on. Firstly, in the initial stages, there were problems between ourselves and PwC precisely because PwC wanted to define itself as a transition advisor as opposed to what was defined in the scope as a transaction advisor. So we had to spend a bit of time around that and so on. And eventually, by the time we got around to sorting it out, we were then, of course, able to get back on track in terms of the work that needed to be done. But also stopping it is precisely informed by the fact that our strategic outlook and factors have essentially changed and altered. We are no longer going out on tender, and therefore we will not. Now, but the question will be then the work that has already been undertaken by PwC, for an example, can that work still be used? And our view is that yes, it can still be used, and CITA, of course, is also tapping into some of the work that has already been undertaken and so forth. Next slide, please. The one question is, why is it that as a department we did not know about these influencing and factors insofar as deviation is concerned and so on? There are a number of probably, our major preoccupation at the time was the question of the development of the ICT strategy for the department, as well as addressing ourselves, yes, to the future outlook, as well as the question of building internal capacity within the department. Now, so we had to review at the time when we had undertaken that we're going out on tender, we had to review, the whole outlook on our side, and then we began to pick up these particular factors, for instance, the CITA Act and so forth. But I think One of the underlying things is that it should also be remembered that for a period of no less than 10 years when the PPP contract was there, the CETA Act was not in the picture. If I'm saying the CETA Act was not in the picture, I'm not saying that it wasn't in existence. It was, because if I'm not mistaken, it's between 98 and 99 that we had the CETA Act. And the PPP contract then came into existence in 2002. But the PPP itself coming into existence did not necessarily take into account the approaches as expected insofar as the CETA Act is concerned and so on. So it is possible that in our own sort of outlook, it's an area that we must have overlooked in one form or the other. When did we know that we will no longer go out on tender? It's of course at the time when we're beginning to consider the SCM processes and issues of budgeting, and the CETA Act as having been highlighted earlier on. At an operational management level, the way they are made to understand that there were debates about, yeah, but shouldn't you also factor in the CETA Act and so forth, but those debates never really filtered through to executive level. As a result of which, we had to take a decision to then put together a full-time team that needed to look at the ICT transition. Now, what would happen beyond the EOH termination support? We are engaging on the question of the takeover of ITC, of IT resources between ourselves and EOH, and CETA also in terms of the service gaps that exist is also coming into the picture in terms of areas where we cannot be able to provide services in-house and so forth. And of importance is that we have a limited time between now and the end of the termination support period, for an example. So will we be able to meet all the deliverables, the outstanding deliverables? There is a possibility that some of the deliverables may not be met, and it must also be remembered that we lost a period of about 4 months when the EOH services were also suspended, amongst other things, and therefore they could not necessarily focus on issues of system development. Was EOH paid for the period when they were suspended? Yes, due to contractual obligations and the fact that EOH still continued to maintain certain services, IT services, and keeping us going to some extent in a limited form during the period of suspension. And how many systems are outstanding? I think that's the outline there: human capital mode, business desk, CF management information systems, inspection enforcement systems, financial system for the UI. And some progress has been made also in terms of rolling out some of these particular systems, and some of them are at a testing stage. Now, insofar as the risk factors, for instance...
Gigi, yes, am I the only one who doesn't have those slides?
Probably.
The difficulty I have is I've got slides here and I've got a presentation here, which really is not what we're hearing. What we're hearing is really different to what this thing is. It would have been very useful to have an updated version of this.
Right.
This talks about tenders and all kinds of things, but now in the verbal presentation we hear, no, there's no more tenders.
Yeah, no. I can see the slides here. That's why I was asking, but am I the only one who doesn't have the slides that the DG is talking to? But if we all don't, that's fine. You can continue.
Yeah, no, thanks, Chair. By the way, these issues are extracted from exactly this particular presentation. So why not you know, we're not necessarily, you know, saying anything else other than what is also in the presentation, except that what we're then saying is that out of the issues identified in the main presentation, these are the issues that are also cropping up. And these are the issues that would have to be satisfied amongst others. So it's not different information for that matter.
Except that that it is listed out and condensed in that presentation would actually have been much more useful. And if anything, probably the most useful part of the presentation, because it talks to the challenges and the issues. And I think that's what we need to be talking to. So, yeah, I would say it is a limitation to some extent, not to have those areas that have been lifted out of this presentation, to say from where we're seated, these are the key areas that we're concerned about or that we need to focus on.
No, we apologize for that, Chair. I think we would also make means to actually distribute this. We thought
if it can happen now, the better. So when we engage, we're properly guided, because I wouldn't want us to be all over,
okay,
you know, and be nowhere. So if means could be made to ensure that that happens now, the better.
Okay. No, that's fine, Chair. Thanks for that. From a risk management front, the question is, what are the top risky areas, for an example? The one is that there is a risk insofar as disruption of service delivery due to discontinuation of IT services. There is also, if we fail to settle amicably between ourselves and EOH around Section 197, for an example, there is potential litigation. That's a risk factor, and that would deviate us further from the core issues around the transition kind of matter. Of course, the budgetary constraints is one of those. The fourth and the fifth risk is about the question of the political risk. Now, the political risk in this sense, in a sense that, for an example, if we take over the EOH resources in their current form, and as a department we are then forced to retrench, we are a Department of Labor in the first instance, and then there is a whole range of issues that are likely to arise from there. And of course, we would
especially imagine retrenching in December, January.
And I suspect you know what that means, potential. Now, there's a question of the reputational risk as well. And that's why it's important for us, for instance, around the question of the Section 197 issue, that we have said, look, let us talk about key critical resources that would make sense to us as the Department of Labor, as opposed to taking everything. And of course, legally, we're not on a sound footing when it comes to that, because in terms of the law, you take everything stock and barrel. But we're trying to arrive at some sort of understanding with the EOH, precisely given our own capacity limitations and so on. Now, what is the position of EOH employees involved with the daily ICT services of the department? Of course, we have alluded to the question of the takeover negotiations between ourselves and them, and how will these employees be accommodated in within the department? I think in the main presentation we showed, for an example, that they have resources of about 200 people. In our establishment is 131, but on top of it, they have the haywire kind of salary structure levels that would be difficult for us to accommodate. So it is possible that if we were to stick to the 131 within the defined sort of salary structure levels as applicable in the department, for an example, that we could absorb some of those employees from EOH, and those that belong to other streams such as finance, HR, and so forth will then be accommodated there. And what is the budget approved for 2013-14 financial year? It's 135 million, and they allocated for the year in question, and it's actually split across the budget of the Department of Labor Compensation Fund and the UI, and that's the split that we the breakdown that that is shown over there. The estimated cost to the termination support, basically, for the 12-month period, the total value stands at 194.8 million, which translates to 16.4 million per month. And of course, there is then the percentage split between ourselves, the UIF, the compensation fund, and so it goes. What is the total amount paid in respect of the IT PPP contract? I think it's an issue that has also been before the parliamentary committees before. That, you know, for the current 10-year period, was paid to 2 billion rands and so on, and we're giving the breakdown in terms of how that 2 billion is actually made up. I think it's a slide. Now, I think I've spoken about the implications for Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act, that firstly we're talking about the wage bill currently on the side of EOH of 12.4 million per month, which means if we were to take everything, that's what we would then have got to inherit. But I also did say, alluded to the fact that you have a disjuncture at a structural level, and what would that mean for us? Next slide, please. There is the question of the outstanding claims between ourselves and EOH arising out of the PPP contract. The one outstanding claim is in respect of the SEP licenses. There have been a series of engagements between the Office of the Chief Financial Officer and the Accounts Manager on the side of the EOH, for an example, to resolve some of this. There is an outstanding meeting between the DG of Labor and the CEO of the EOH to look at the proposals that are beginning to come through from these series of engagements, and how those issues would have to be to be resolved. So basically, this stage, there is this particular SEP license is the outstanding claim. Is there potential for litigation? I think I've alluded to this, that the litigation factor is all dependent on the extent to which we firmly negotiate and reach amicable resolution between ourselves and EOH. Next slide, please. Is that it? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No. Thanks very much. Yeah, that's. Those are the issues that we lifted out of the main presentation. Thanks.
Thanks very much, DG. I'll try and summarize what I've heard. And I hope I'm wrong. I'll be happy to be wrong. What I understand the department to be saying, comrades, is that 10 years later, after 2 billion rand, and with 3 or whatever months to go through the termination support period, there have been no skills transfer in the department. That's number one. Number two, Siemens, which is a private company. That's why it was a triple P, public-private partnership, which has been bought by EOH. They were employees, and now that the contract is over, the department is supposed to absorb all those employees. Understand, we are not on a sound legal footing, meaning the wording of the contract either obliges the department to take that stuff, all of it, or some other explanation that we may need to hear. So that's the long and the short of this briefing. That's how I get it. And that's why I'm saying I hope I'm wrong. All right. Let me allow comrades to make their input. Comrade Roy, Memangena, Singh, then Ntate Mtao. Yes.
Yeah, Chair, I agree with what you've said. In addition, I'm finding it very difficult to match what I'm reading, what I'm hearing, and what I'm seeing. For me, there is some confusion. For example, earlier on one of the slides, you indicated, I think, four or five of your top risks. Yet here in the presentation I have before me, on page 9, the non-existence of IT continuity plan post-EOH is listed as a risk. It isn't. I didn't see it on the slide. In addition, the most recent report of the AG that I have, 212, also lists that as your major problem. Let me read it to you, part of it. The business continuity plan, which should have been a basis for IT governance framework to direct the positioning of IT, was not developed. And as you pointed out, Chair, we've had these people at, what, 2 billion rand over 11 years? What the hang did they do? Not developed and not implemented. So I want to know, why is that now no longer a risk? I'm then assuming you in fact have. You've met the AG's concerns and you now have this plan in place. Could you clarify that, please? Then, Chair, like you, I'm also concerned about Siemens EOH. Over 11 years, was it not part of the scope of their work, their mandate, to develop an IT strategy? Over all of those years, what did we pay them for? Then finally, my third question, could you clarify the role of PwC? Because again, there seems to be a discrepancy with what I have in front of me and with what I've heard. Because in the presentation I've got before me, PwC is given a range of tasks. There's no page number, but PwC is expected to develop specifications. Are they still doing that? And why do you not have the in-house capacity to do that yourselves? Why must you outsource that? Here, written before me, and you said, no, it's no longer happening, is that tenders are going out. If these tenders were going out, then again you would have depended on PwC, because they are expected to, in terms of the presentation, to assist with the issuing of these tenders. Why no in-house capacity? They, in terms of the written presentation, would assist with the process of service level agreements. Now, I think I heard you say in the verbal part of the presentation, tenders are no longer going out. So therefore, I assume that PwC is no longer doing that work. What are they doing then? If you could just clarify that for me, please. Thanks.
Right. Memangena, nothing, and then Dr. Mutau.
Chairperson, thank you. Some of the questions have been asked by Honorable Roy. You remember last time when we were driving somewhere around Eden Valley, I asked about this EOH. What is its meaning? The name in full. I just want the name in full. And then, as Honorable Roy was saying, PwC, because you say that you have terminated their contract. Are we still not going to pay them after terminating the contract? Because I know they had a contract with you people and you were paying them. And then now that we are terminating them, are we not still going to pay them? What will happen if you say to EOH, no, we are not taking your employees because we got 131, maybe you want to add something to them to make them 200, maybe 69 to make them 200, as you said. I don't know if they will agree. And you are saying that four of them are paid as premiers, the wages that premiers are being given, and 12, they get a salary that is getting by the DGs. How are you really going to make it? Because I see there's going to be a problem. Maybe if the court says that, no, you take them, it means that you must take those employees as well. And what about your own employees? Are we going to drop them? That's why the chair is saying January, February, March. He was counting, and I know what he actually means. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members and colleagues. Firstly, I would agree with your summation, particularly with the question of whether the department is obliged to take over the staff and to boot at the kind of salaries that Honorable Mangena has been just talking about. But for me, Chairperson, this seems to be like a case of Rip Van Winkle. You know, went to sleep, got up one day after 10 years, 11 years, and realized, hey, there's this monster we got here that we created. Treasury was part of it, and I would like to hear what Treasury has to say in this regard as well. And suddenly, what do we do? They're not providing the kind of service. We didn't do anything to them while they were not providing the service. We heard from our visit when we went to compensation fund that they are very unhappy with the type of services, and they have put blame on the inability of Siemens to provide them with proper ICT services on the backlogs that exist. So I just want to know also from Treasury, what happened? And we are being given a presentation here today, and I agree with Honorable Roy, that the presentation by the DG was a very critical presentation, because that brings us into focus, and it's something that we didn't have. But it's a case of six of one, half a dozen of the other. We are saying that was bad, because we've realized after 11 years it was bad. We've got something else which we think will take us forward, but there are lots of risks that are involved in it. You must now say yes to it, and then we will also be part of the blame moving forward when next COPA sits, to say, well, this COPA said, well, well done, thank you guys, move on to this new system that you are trying to introduce. And I don't think that's fair on us as this COPA. I'd also like to know, Chairperson, CETA. I mean, there are a lot of challenges that are ascribed here to CETA. They can't do this, they can't do that, they can't do that, and whatever. Let's hear from them. Let's hear from CETA. They hear? Let's hear from them whether or not these challenges do exist, because in terms of legislation, they are the ones that are supposed to be providing this, the services to all departments. And lastly, I want to know, in consultation, UIF and WC, are they taken fully on board? Is this a department-run initiative to introduce new ICT systems? Or are these two entities, you know, being brought on board as we move forward? Because they are the ones that we question when things go wrong. So those are the few comments for now, Chair.
All right. What I'll do is, I want the last two to ask their questions, so that I'm sure the initial response of the department would assist in further clarifying the issue, so that we can start to narrow down on those key strategic issues from the presentation. So just hold it, Tosh. We'll definitely come back to you. Remutau, and then Dr. Rabi, then let's get a response. Sita, no. I'm definitely aware they will need to come at some point, but I felt let the department clarify in terms of what they are presenting to us, and then we can then engage beyond that.
Thank you, Chair. This issue has been a big, big problem for me. The department knows about it, especially starting with the $2 billion for which we have nothing to show. But what concerns me now is getting worse. Not only did we spend $2 billion on the PPP, which didn't give us anything, we then got into EOH, and the department needs to, you know, explain to us why they would like to go out now post EOH into a non-tender situation when there were very serious questions about how EOH got into the picture. So there are very serious issues here, and my problem is that unless we can contain the situation, it will keep on going and going and going. We're talking 12 million a month, we're talking 8 million a month. It doesn't seem to stop. So I think we need to just hold it here and find out. And indeed, the question has been raised, you know, the role of PwC. So for me, the concern is this thing is not going to stop. It seems like the department hasn't learned a thing from the debacle, which was the PPP with Siemens.
Chair, my question ties up with the Honourable Mattau. I want to know the principal agents that initiated the PPP contract or the termination support period. The department of who were the agents? Who were the people that were responsible for that particular contract, that termination support period? Because it seems to me nothing has really changed. That termination support period favors EOU and Siemens, and it's going to cost the taxpayer billions and billions of rand. And I'd just like to have further clarity on that, Chairman. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Chair, Honourable Members. Firstly, Honourable Ainsley, there is no contradiction. When you talk of the five risks that I referred to, you will see that risk number one on the five risks that I mentioned is disruption of service delivery due to discontinuation of IT services. That's risk number one. So in a sense, between that point and what you see in the main presentation, there's absolutely no conflict. Now, we had said before, and I think it relates to the point that Honorable Ainsley had also raised, the question of what about in-house capacity. We have said before that at the initiation stages of the PPP contract in 2002, over the period, as a department, we did not have in-house capacity, for an example. And here we are, we're talking about some technical aspects of, the need to go out on tender and so on, and you therefore need not only just competent people, but highly competent people to be able to do this kind of thing. Now, the capacity constraint is the fact that in-house, we do not have that kind of a capacity. And it's not a point that just happened today or yesterday. And so on. Over the years, as I'm just saying, our internal capacity was essentially decimated, and so it goes. Now, why did we ask PwC to come into the picture? We asked PwC to come into the picture to assist us as we call them, the transaction advice. In other words, moving from this environment around the existing PPP into a new environment altogether, as dictated by our strategic outlook, amongst other things. So we needed that kind of technical expertise and capacity in that regard. Now, but as and when we were taking stock and reviewing a number of these matters, we then began identifying all these constraints and so forth, which then dictated that we needed to change course. And that's what the emergent strategy factors, as they presented earlier on, actually allude to, that you know, we said we were moving in this particular direction. But as and when we're beginning to review certain things, it actually tells you that there is a particular direction that we need to take, which is different from the originally.
Or maybe, why don't we, because you see, the summation of all the questions that were raised, I think for me they raise basically three issues. Firstly, maybe if you could, say to us, in terms of your own assessment, what were the deficiencies of the Triple P? Two, what were the gaps and lapses in the department that hindered you from fully leveraging the Triple P, which then has led us to where we are, and to say what are the challenges we're facing now, so that we're able to then put into context all the various things that you're doing, emanating from that past and the current challenges that it has produced. In a very, you know, simple, and so that we can understand, because I think the issue here is exactly why are we here? Why are we having all these things? I think all these questions, they basically talk to that.
Chair. Now, I hear you, Honorable Chair. look, we had, you know, you're asking quite a difficult question, not necessarily because the question itself is difficult, but precisely because in satisfying it, you need a thoroughgoing sort of analysis. And there's a report that we produced also when we were nearing the end of the Triple P contract, if I'm not mistaken, which was taking stock of the whole range of issues. And we have been quite open and honest about some of our problems. Amongst those, for an example, is the question of the mere fact that we are of the opinion that we had no capacity to properly manage the Triple P contract. We had no such capacity precisely because, amongst other things, in terms of just your physical resources, we're not there. and so it goes. So a number of these issues I don't know how to put it, but I think that have been there in the making in one form or the other and so forth over a period of time. Now, as I'm just saying that, it would have been very useful if we were to do an overall assessment of the Triple P analysis and capturing an experience and reflecting on it. I think it would have been a different matter altogether. Now,
we're going to deal with the review of original intention, it means we have to deal with that history, understand it, so as to understand why we are where we are today. Because, like I say, all these questions that comrades are asking, they are about, but why are we here? Why are we in this situation? Or why are we doing certain things? So if we have that historical understanding, it will go a long way in assisting everybody to understand.
If I may, Chairperson. The question you asked was around what were the deficiencies of the Triple P. And we've done an evaluation around the lessons learned around the Triple P. And some of the issues that came out from that, first one was that initially there was a relationship breakdown between the two parties, Siemens at the time and the Department of Labor. So there were issues around the relationships that have deteriorated around between the two parties. The second high-level finding was that there was a lack of ICT governance, functioning ICT governance structures that were there to manage the PPP. The third one was the amount and extent of management involvement and decision-making on the PPP, and I'm talking to the Department of Labor's involvement around that. There was a lack of capacity to actually manage the contract itself. There was nobody in the department that was allocated as the contract manager, and only towards the latter part of the PPP there was a resource brought in through CETA to assist with this. Another finding was that there was no capacity in the department, and especially in the office of the CIO, to actually manage the PPP. There was three people, I think, just three people to manage a 2 billion rand contract over 10 years. So there was no capacity to manage that. I think at a high level, Chair, those were the key issues that were the deficiencies around that.
Now, in terms of the content of the contract itself, what were the deficiencies?
If I may?
Or some of the challenges that have arisen, arising out of the legal commitment that the department had set itself, or in terms of the agreement themselves.
Just at the top of my head, I'm going to try and respond to that, Chair. I think, firstly, the contract was very skewed towards the service provider, towards Siemens at that time. And the department entered into a contract that wasn't favorable, fully favorable to the department. Secondly, I think the service provider themselves, Siemens, were the wrong service provider. Thirdly, because Siemens globally is a service provider in the IT space that used to provide machines, boxes, and they were not there for systems development, for example. Thirdly, I think the contract was for too long a period. It was too long. A 10-year period is too long for a contract. Especially in the ICT environment, it's such a dynamic and changing environment. A contract, although the contract makes some provision for reviewing current status, like I said, as point number one, it was skewed in terms of that. I think at a high level, those are the three key issues.
All right. Yeah, then you can continue, DG, so that if there are specific... I'll come back to you, comrade. I just wanted to try and tease out some of the things so that our responses must have some bit of context. Mm.
Okay. No, thanks. Thank you very much, Chair. There was a question about, I think it relates to Section 197. The Honourable Mangena also has posed this question. We are hoping, for instance, that we necessarily do not have got to go the legal route with EOH, and that's why we are in discussions and negotiations with them around the takeover of resources and the capacity building. She's smiling at me.
No, don't mind. Just continue.
So we're hoping, sincerely, we're hoping that we necessarily do not go that route. I mean, it's an undesirable situation for.
But you see, DG, the point that I think you're not getting into, which I think is of critical interest, is how is the department tied up to the staff of EOH or Siemens? Is it because we did not develop internal capacity, or is it because you said we are not on a sound legal footing? I think if you can talk to that, it would go a long way.
It has nothing to do. I mean, I was just simply giving a qualification in nature around the question of the legal footing, for an example. You know, it has nothing to do with the legalities that much, really. It's the whole question of, building internal capacity within the department. And, of course, in terms of how PPP contract itself expects parties in the contract to deal with the question of the handover of services, for an example. So
what does the contract say in relation to that handover?
I'm being simplistic. EOH staff are EOH staff. You are the department, you're a different entity. When EOH goes, the staff goes. Now, that's very simplistic. Please explain what this contract says that contradicts what I'm saying.
And, Captain, in addition to that, how do I take a person who's earning more than what I get?
No, it's fine. I think that's what we want them to respond to.
I will try and respond to the question. I'm an IT person.
It's a very expensive question. I think that should be one of the first that you know in the utmost of detail. How are you bound? How are you linked to taking stuff that will cost you millions?
Okay, I'm going to try and respond to it. Like I say, I'm an IT person. But Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act says that when the... An organization, in this case our relationship with EOH and as the Department of Labor, we have to take over resources that have been providing the services to the Department of Labor. So it's a prescriptive option in Section 197 that says, as a going concern, we have to take over the resources.
Okay. No, I was not stopping you. I was saying, yeah, I hear you. Continue.
I was hoping you understood it. I didn't expect it.
Okay.
To explain, when the old PPP contract was put into place, all the employees of the department that were in that space were transferred over to Siemens, which then gave rise to this section of 197 to say if the department still did that service, and as a going concern, when we take it over, we have to consider the employees in terms of that section, the employees that were transferred. That's where the employees in that are in EOH come into being in terms of finalizing this contract. They were initially in the Department of Labor. When the PPP was put into place, they were transferred over to Siemens to do the same service to the Department of Labor, which gave rise to this section. They come back with these high salaries, because when they come back, we cannot put them into a disadvantaged situation.
No, I think then that clears the matter. Not that we agree, but at least we understand the facts. Okay, I'll give the chair, I'll give Hoshi, I'll give Comrade Shiloh.
Thanks, Chairperson. Now, did you know that the last time when we were given a brief about the PPP contract, I remember somebody saying, "Oh, majority of the people who joined, who were absorbed by Siemens, were since later ended up even leaving Siemens because they got frustrated. They were sent to other places that don't necessarily deal with what they were dealing with. Are we sure that all the people on the EOA staff, all of them in that top management, are they people who were in the department before? Because there could be new people who were employees of EOA who have never actually even worked for the department. And you sound a bit surprised by the salaries. I thought maybe when the contract was signed, you should be knowing what you are signing on, what these people will be earning, so that when you take them, you will budget accordingly. So I must say, it sounds like you are surprised about the salaries of these people. Or is it only me who is surprised by the salaries?
Hush.
Chair, thanks. Of course, this is the question where I will be sitting on, Chair. Maybe I should start by checking Is it correct that the department requested to brief us about this development? Or did we ask them to come and brief us? If they asked us to be briefed by them, I want to believe that it should have been a holistic decision of the department. And therefore, the first question is, where is the minister then? Is she aware of this briefing? Is she aware of the contradictions that we are going to deal with them here today? Chair, the second question, why are we not given the contract documents to see the content for ourselves? Because it looks like the devil is in that particular document. We may talk, they will tell us what is good for them, they may not tell us what is bad for them. I wanted to know again, who were from the department forming part of the individuals who were signing this agreement, who advised the department to enter into this kind of, a very tidy kind of a contract, which today they are unable to budge. How do you want to absorb, an employee who the salary is above average in terms of, what government is supposed to pay any other employee within the Republic of South Africa? How did they arrive at that particular decision? Who are these officials? Are they still part of the department? Are the legal, gurus of the department still sitting there? Were they part of the whole, thing that they've entered into them? Because they're tied up, Chairperson, where we are now. It looks like if you entered into an agreement, And the agreement is saying, by the time we arrive at the lapse of the agreement, you should then take over. They themselves are saying, we were supposed to take only staff that we required their services. They themselves, the EOH, they are saying all of us, because they are seeing a potential of continuing living a better life in this particular kind of, agreement that we are talking about. I would be happy, Chair, if we were to be given people who were sitting in this kind of agreement. Where are they today? Are they, not on the very same, list of the 4 and 12 of the most high, individuals? It's possible these individuals, they might have been, by the time they were in the department, Chairperson, possibly they might have been at the rank 3-4 steps below the DG. But today they wanted to become not even the DG, but above DG in an abnormal way. I guess, Chair, maybe we need to get things that we are not even sure whether we'll ever have them there. My final department, Chair, question is, if the demands in terms of the contract is to say you take all of them with the ranks, with the salaries that they are getting, is it something that emerged now, or is it something that was in the contract? And then was the contract clearly stipulating that at that particular time you should know that the salaries might be above what you are, giving to any employee in the Department of Labor? Thank you, Chair.
Comrade Chulwan.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question was partly asked by Honorable Singh and Honorable Hoshi, but I just want to take a different angle in asking that question. It's in relation with this briefing that you are having, whether to establish whether are we supposed to give a green light to the department to say, go on, or we're supposed to say what? I don't know, Chairperson, maybe if you could assist me on that one before I continue with my questions.
Well, the department asked to give us information, so we're getting information. Continue.
So we're not liable if anything goes wrong to say that.
No.
The department has wanted to scope
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question, it will be on the implications, page 17, to check. There are lines there. My first one, it will be on the liaison. The department, they say they continue to liaise with CETA for additional requirements. Maybe I should put my question in this regard, maybe to check this transition. The department has finalized the agreement. Maybe to check who's going to do this work, this ICT. Who has been awarded this tender? I'm asking that because I'm saying if you continue to liaise with CETA for additional requirements and how much is going to cost the department in respect with what you have agreed with, who's ever going to do this work. The second one is also to check on also the stopping of all current appointments in ICT. Is it within the department or is it within the staff that's being transferred into from EOH? My last question, Chairperson, is at page, what is it? There's no number. It's on the costing. The DG said that the monthly cost, it's a green paper on the costing. The monthly cost was 12.3 million per month. And now I think is the current one, the anticipated one, which the department is going to go ahead with the new service provider, is going to cost 8.5 million. What is the time frame for the current, for this newly appointed service provider? And how much are we going to save in terms of the budget allocated, in terms of that was the 10 years, the 11 years that you had and the current one that you are going to continue with? Thank you, Chair.
Dr. George, I think Dr. George and, maybe let's have two questions and then.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page number 3, on the areas of major concern, there's a question, the last question, and it says, why were these factors not highlighted as strategic constraints or raised at executive structures? And then the answer to that is the issues raised at operational management level did not filter through to executive level. This has been addressed through a full-time team, etc. Now, this was a very expensive and a highly strategic issue, this IT matter. I mean, it's cost a lot of money, it's been very controversial, etc. Taxpayers have paid a lot of money and haven't seen much value. So why was the executive not closer to this issue? Because surely there would be somebody executive responsible for IT who would say, look, this is a very important thing, I must keep my eye on this as an individual. And then collectively the executive would say, well, this is a big thing, so we must be close to it. So how come that was not the case? And why is nobody being held to account? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I've got only two questions. The first question is, if you are going to take, I mean, the DG was talking about taking over people who are earning about the salary of the premiers. Are these people directors of EOH? Because the way you are talking is as if you are going to absorb EOH as is with its directors. That's what I wanted to check. The second point is that the DG talks about concerns and everything else, but he does not talk about the way forward getting out of this particular situation. What I wanted to check is, what is the department doing to get out of this particular situation with all the experiences, with all the lessons learned? What steps is the department taking to get out of this particular situation, to normalize the situation?
All right. Can we get a response to...
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think let me start off why are we here? Because I thought, is this thing working? Okay.
It is working.
Okay. I thought probably that question would be simply understood. We have appeared a number of times before parliamentary committees, and we're on public record having made particular undertakings, amongst which honourable members was the question of I think we even said that by the end of June, latest July, we'll be going out on tender. You know, we're on record here in this particular institution, as having said so. Now, if you have factors, and I suppose these are issues around principles of accountability, I suspect, if you then have factors that begin to change the original goals, we are duty-bound to come back and say, in our efforts to pursue this strategic objective, for an example, here are the factors that are beginning to change the actual outlook. So we felt that it's an important thing for us to come back to Parliament and brief Parliament about the emergence of these particular factors and how these factors are then impacting on some of the undertakings that we have made ourselves publicly, precisely because there had been a huge sort of concern and outcry around the Triple P and so it goes. I mean, in the experience that I've had with the honourable members in this particular institution, is that there have been very huge kind of concerns around the issue. So if you have factors that impact on how we need to then go forward, it's imperative that we need to come back and say, this is the situation. We are not saying that we need a particular green light. We are saying, we said we will go out on tender. The situation says that we will not be able to go out on tender. We are saying we cannot do so precisely because of these particular constraints, amongst others, is the budgetary constraints, legislative constraints, for instance, insofar as the CETA Act is concerned and so forth. That's all that we're then saying. Honourable Khanna raises the question, which I think is important. So what is the way forward? We have articulated both in the main presentation and the strategic questions that we've lifted out to then say, look, there are ongoing engagements, for an example. CETA is also coming into the picture in terms of assisting us. That's one part. But the other part is, of course, trying to resolve some of these outstanding questions with EOH around the question of SEP claims, for an example. We said there's now only one outstanding kind of claim. We have also said that there's the question of the Section 197, and going forward, there need to be a strategic engagement at the management of EOH and management of the Department of Labor to resolve some of these particular questions. Now, I think at some point, Honourable Chair, we may need to. I agree. Over the 10-year period, it's the 2 billion rands that was spent on the IT services. But by their very nature, IT services are extremely expensive. And I think if we were to do some just minimal research and just benchmark ourselves, you would find that the outcry that we have about the 2 billion over the 10-year period, compared to the spend of other departments, for an example, it's probably minimal. The 2 billion rands that
I think the outcry is not so much the price tag, but it's what we have out of that price tag.
Yeah. No. I'm just then just making an example. So they say by their very nature, IT services are expensive. And perhaps point.
I think we agreed.
Okay.
That's why I'm saying the issue is not the price tag, but it is what did we get out of that.
Right.
I think that's the point. Not so much that it should have been 500 million or 1 billion or whatever.
I agree, Chair, but I'm moving on to the other question
sure,
now,
sure.
But which prefaces exactly the same way I've made about the point that Honourable Khanna has made about, the salary bill of these people. My answer would be to say that I think we need to take into account that the IT services, yes, they're expensive, but also IT companies, they tend to pay and pay very well. And perhaps that's why we have this situation about the expensive sort of human resources, for instance, which we then have got to. Now, I think Dr. Rabi asked a question that about the termination support agreement. The termination support agreement flows out of the PPP agreement. If I'm not mistaken, second, is it Article 12 or 13 of the PPP, which Annexure 12, yeah, sure. Thanks. Annexure 12 of the PPP agreement, which is your main contract, then alludes to the need of entering into a termination support period, which cannot be more than a 12-month period. So that's the clarification around that. I mean, basically, your termination support period is more to do with transition and looking into issues of what outstanding services, for instance, would have to be completed within that particular period, but whilst at the same time moving over onto a new ICT environment. Is the minister briefed, Koshi? The minister is briefed, knows about this meeting, has been briefed about the turn of events in terms of where the situation currently stands. Now, there is something that I'm not sure whether I understood, Chair, about the question of the contract documents. that you need to I think you are referring to contract documents, talking about the PPP contract documents. I don't know how many volumes of a contract that is. Now,
specifically the one of themselves and the service provider that we are talking about.
Oh, so in other words, you are referring to the termination support agreement. Okay. The whole PPP.
Yes, correct. Yeah, that was his question.
The whole PPP. Wow. Okay. Now, if it is the decision of this panel committee that you so direct that you need to have the copies of the contract, we can certainly make them available. But the CFO is giggling because I talk about serious volumes here. Yeah, 10 volumes actually. So, but it's all right if that is what you will be wanting to look at. It's okay. Dr. George, the question of, I think I did when we're dealing with the question of some of these issues and how the filtering of information between the operational levels and executive, that at an executive level, I think the preoccupation in the main was there were a few points of emphasis. The one was the question of an ICT strategy, which had not been there. The other one was the question of how do we then move over from the current situation into the next, and so it goes. So those were the major issues. It now transpires, for an example, that at an operational level, when there were engagements amongst some of our operatives there, some people did raise the issue of the CETA Act, for an example. But I'm also then saying that perhaps at our level, the issue of, because at the initiation stages of the PPP, for instance, the CETA Act was not the focal point. So we may have probably, not overseen, man. I don't know what the proper English word. We may have, overlooked that specific area. So that we accept, and we had spoken about that. I'll ask Mr. Sekerson to talk about. I think there was a chain. I'm just trying to check one specific question here that was raised that I think it. Oh yes, Mr. The Honourable Nchabeleng spoke about the question of, are we certain that the people that we're talking about, are they originally, all of them, former employees of the Department of Labour that we now have got to take over from UOH? So I'll ask Mr. Sekerson, because he's also part of a team that deals with the issue of Section 197, to also give us a picture around that. Thanks, Chair.
Sorry, can they also answer the question of consultation with UIF and Workmen's Comp, because that hasn't been there. And then the other point is, you know, what I'd like to ask is Siemens to EOH. The slide says prior to the end of the PPP. How close to the end of that contract did EOH come in? Was it just a matter of convenience for some individuals or for the company? How did EOH come onto the scene? We're not hearing how EOH came. And if it's a going concern, I mean, why buy a company as a going concern? I mean, are you taking over the company? And if I buy SAA as a going concern, I don't have the money, Koshy has the money to do that. He'll have to take everything over. But, you know, why this going concern take over?
All right. Okay.
Dion? I'll start with the UIF, the Unemployment Insurance Fund, and the Compensation Fund. They have been part of the Triple P contract from the inception. So the Triple P contract is split one-third between the three parties, that is the Department of Labor, the Compensation Fund, and the Unemployment Insurance Fund. The question around when was Siemens taken over by EOH, I think EOH bought over Siemens IT services in South Africa for, just maybe to take a step back and give you a perspective, Siemens IT was a global IT solutions company, IT services company, and Siemens sold that whole business unit across the world. In South Africa, EOH bought that IT, Siemens IT services components, and I think it was around September, October 2012 when EOH bought them over. The other question I needed to respond to was, who are the people that signed the Triple P contract? The Triple P was signed in 2002, around October, November 2002. And it was then the signatories at that time was the Director General of the Department of Labor at that time. It was Mr. Renz Ramashia who signed the contract, and he was advised by the then CIO of the department, Dr. Hasbrook, I think. There was a question about the stopping of appointments. Is it internal or is it EOH? The stopping of the appointments is actually internally, because we have an approved structure. If we have to take over the resources of EOH, then we're going to have to take them over onto that approved structure that we have. So we had to stop going out to the market to bring in additional resources. I'm not sure if I've missed any questions out, Jefferson.
Chairperson, the time frame of the contract that is just going to start, how long is it going to be anticipated by the department in terms of your own agreement, the time frame? Two, it's a question on the, I've also asked on the additional requirements by CETA. The budget constraint, in terms of the budget constraint.
page 17, and the other one doesn't have a page, that one, the one that does, because it's reached total EOH resources monthly cost 12.3 and worst case scenario. And the other one that you are anticipating now is going to be less. Let's check on that one. Thank you.
I'm sure we'll be, maybe after your response, check with CETA if there's any input they may want to make to further assist us in having clarity on this issue.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The costing is not relating to a tender that is going out. The costing is that is on the screen relates to the cost of taking over employees onto the Department of Labor. So those are the people that we are going to take over to provide the IT services to the department. When we say worst case scenario, it means that if we have to take over all the resources that are providing the services, that it will cost us $12.3 million. If we take over only the services that we require, and that is the ICT operational services, it will cost us $8.5 million. The time frame for doing this is we need to complete it by the end of November this year. In terms of costing, I think what we have found out now that we have actually explored the market in terms of ICT costing, we have actually, and let me just quickly give you what the Triple P, how it was broken down. 70% of the Triple P contract related to the provision of ICT operational services. That means it was the day-to-day services, it was licenses, the data center, and all the things that forms the daily services in terms of ICT. 30% of the contract related to the building of new systems. And that's where the biggest problems lie, because the systems were not built, and when they were not built properly. But when we go to market and look at costing now, we find that in terms of the Triple P, we have been paying a lot less than what we would have been paying in actual terms now. So although it might have been costly, we look at $2 billion over 10 years as being a big amount, but if we look at and we benchmark against what the cost of services are now, and CETA might have to respond, but if we just compare to CETA, CETA's costing is more than what we were actually paying in terms of the Triple P. So
we've clarified that point. Right. Let's not talk about costing. That's not our point. Our point, even if it was 100 million, would have said 100 million, what did you get for it? That's the point. That's the point we're at. Not so much that it's 2 billion. Could have been 1 billion, could have been 500 million, or anything else. Because we're now into, but maybe there's a question we'll check later. So I was just saying, let's not go into the 2 billion rands. That's not a fundamental point in terms of the actual cost.
I think I've responded to all the questions.
Can I check with CETA? There's an input you are able to make, and we had sought your presence, understanding your role in the ICT environment for the state. Want to check your understanding of the issues we are dealing with and where you stand as a public entity.
Thanks, Chairperson and members of the committee and colleagues from the department.
And welcome in your new role.
Thank you, Chair. I think there's a few issues that perhaps one needs to reflect on. One is the issue that's arising around the origin of the PPP and whether CETA would have played a role or not. I think the point that I can make in relation to that is that Act 88 of 1998, which is the original legislation that established CETA, was amended in 2002. I think the 2002 Act is 66 or something. 2002. The amendment of that legislation brought in the dispensation as we know it today. And when we talk about this Triple P, we can't talk about this Triple P without understanding that in the intervening period, the legislation changed. And the Triple P was concluded in 2002, and that legislation came into existence in 2002. So it would have been, the process leading to the Triple P would have considered the legislation of 1998 as opposed to have considered the 2002 legislation. So it is against that background that the department was able to do the Triple P on its own, even though CETA was in existence. Because the two pieces of legislation are having things that are different in them. So I think that backdrop needs to be noted. The second thing is in relation to the issues that are being deliberated on today. I have a slight difficulty, but I will address the issues because it would have been we haven't had an opportunity, myself and the DG, to talk about these issues. It would have helped if that opportunity had happened, but the time has not allowed that to happen. We've tried several times, both of us, to meet. The first point is that our first interaction in relation to the renewal of this contract with the department was in June 2011. And I think it's important that that point is in the picture, and it will become clearer later why I want to put that point in. Now, we all know that CETA as an institution has had challenges, and I think, again, early on in the discussion, one needs to put that point in that as an organization, we've had challenges, and perhaps some of the challenges, and now it's a hypothetical point whether we would have been able to do this or not. For CETA to reach out in 2011 was because it takes time to put in place processes to deal with a project of this nature. I think this is a complex project. It's not just a basic project that you can just take over and run with it immediately. You need to plan properly. You need to resource the organization properly in order to respond. Unfortunately, that process did not bear fruit. We then received a letter from the DG at the beginning of this year, and again, there were interactions between CETA and the department in this regard. Up until the time the decision was taken by the department not to proceed with the tender process in July, there were interactions. We then have received further communication from the department which clarifies what the department requires from CETA beginning of August, the 6th of August. On the 6th of August, that latest communication sort of clarifies what is expected of CETA. Flowing from that, we have had interactions as the department has indicated, which in the interactions have not been concluded as yet. Part of what transpires in this discussion is that we may be the fallback option in the event that the Section 197 option that the department has chosen to take based on the considerations the department has, creates problems. I need to caution, even though we have interactions, I need to caution that that fallback position may have difficulties because of the point that I made earlier, that you really need to put in place a proper plan and the resources so that you are able to respond appropriately. So that as a risk is a big risk, because we all know the institution that I'm responsible for, that it has had challenges. Those challenges have not been resolved, all of them. Now, if you bring in this matter with the time frame that we have, we obviously would have to put our heads together with the DG and find a way in which we resolve this, but it will pose serious challenges. So, I'm saying a few things. I'm saying, one, we need to understand the existence of the PPP in the context of the fact that the CETA Act changed. We need to understand that CETA at some stage tried to engage the department primarily because of the focus the 2002 legislation has in relation to ICT matters, and also because of the challenges that taking a project like this would entail, so that there would have been a proper planning to deal with that. And thirdly, that the fallback position that we are engaged with the department on does have risks, particularly because of that complexity. Without entering into a debate, I think the CIO, we do know that CETA's costs are said to be expensive, but it's better to deal with it as a fact rather than as a supposition. Because it helps when we talk factually. We can then, as CETA, try and resolve those things and make sure that the organization responds to the mandate as per legislation, that is to drive down costs and so on. But at this point, we do not have a full costing of this particular project. In fact, the last two pieces of paper that would deal with that, I understand, are supposed to be delivered to the department today. So unless obviously the point that was made comes from interactions that would have indicated that as a fact, I don't know. Thank you.
All right.
Sorry, Chair, can I just clarify the last
one? Sure.
You would see that in the presentation that we made, I think we outlined four options. And the one other option was the question of CETA having got to take over, it says the CETA take on of IT services with EOH resources. But also in the block, we are also saying that this is not a feasible option, as CETA is going through its own transformation and already have redundant staff and so on. I think we're making that particular point. I would apologize if it means that the impression created is that this is a position that has been arrived at between ourselves and CETA, because it is not so. We're just saying these are the options that can be considered, but if in looking into each particular option, you then realize that this one is not the feasible one. So the question of the CETA take on the IT services with the OH resources, we're saying it ourselves that it's actually not. It's not the one that we'll want to opt for.
Okay. No, that's fine. So the only option on the table is Section 197. Can you maybe talk more about Section 197? Because, well, we don't have the benefit of having gone through it. And just go in a bit of detail in terms of what prescriptions does it give, and so that we can have a proper understanding. Because I think, comrades, all what this talk that we've had boils down to is that the only way the department is going to move forward is to apply Section 197. take over the staff of EOH to ensure that there is continuity of ICT services in the department, full stop, with all the consequences, especially around salaries and, salaries. That's it. That's the long and the short of it.
Can they answer the going concern question to Chepas?
Well, I'm sure his explanation on Section 197 will actually talk to us so that we have an understanding of what that section entails.
Chair, we're trying to locate the, we want to peg it up there, the actual section from the Labor Relations Act, because I think that would assist us, as opposed to interpretation and translation.
If it's going to take some time, we can go on with interpretation so that we have a sense. I think that's what we want. We want to have a sense, a fuller sense of what it entails and how we...
Good morning, Chairperson. I'm Andrikus van der Westen and a member of the Portfolio Committee on Labour. And my apologies for joining you late this morning. Chairperson, I'm sitting here with the main agreement between Department of Labour and Siemens Business Services signed on the 27th of November. It's 51 pages.
November of which year?
2002, sorry.
Are you sure that's the main one? I'm told that one is volumes.
This is 51 pages, including the cover page, but obviously there are some annexures, and the annexures may be thicker. I have them. I didn't bring them with me this morning, and I think there are only a
few. How many volumes are the annexures?
Chairperson, I would think they are not more than 100 pages. It may be 150 pages. But there are obviously some annexures dealing with the staff being taken over by Siemens. And I presume in those annexures the details of the staff are stated there. When this agreement was signed, there were two options, well, there were three options. First one, which wasn't said this morning, is that the department could have voluntarily cancelled this contract after 4 years by giving appropriate notice to Siemens. The second one is that it was envisaged that after 10 years this contract may be renewed if the department so wishes, or if the department gave the appropriate notice that they could go out on re-tender. And I'm obviously asking myself, if another company got this tender now, you know, what would have been the position of
can
of
we
the
please
stock?
Have our cellular phones off, because as it rings it means whatever he's saying is not being recorded.
So what I'm say is that in terms of the staff transfer, the agreement only deals with the issue of the staff being transferred from the department to Siemens. And it is quiet on, you know, the staff's position at the end of this agreement, because at the end of this agreement, either it would have been renewed or the department would have found another supplier. And it now seems to me as if the department is exercising a third option, and that is to not re-advertise, which I think is possible, obviously, under this agreement. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that assist to further, but it's fine. Let's talk to Section 197.
Try and tell you what Section 197 deals with. Okay.
Sure.
Section 197 deals with the transfer of a business or a service and the rights and obligations of the employer and employees
from that transfer. So what that means in the case of the department is that the resources providing the service to the department have to be taken over by the department. So I'm just going to try and beam.
Why? Why should the department take those services
I have in front then a the amendment to section 197 from 2002. So if I may read it, Chair, my understanding is what I've just said. And it's not mine. And it's not mine. Oh, so Chair, it's probably the thing that I'm using. Okay, so if I'm just going to try and, like I said, I'm not an expert on this, so I'll try. I'll refer you to number three.
Don't you have an expert in the department? Yeah. I mean, all these officials here, is there no expert on...
Okay, so maybe I just refer you to number three on there. So number three says, if a transfer of a business takes place, then unless otherwise agreed, the contracts of employment in existence immediately before the transfer employees automatically transfers to the new employer. So this is the option that we are mandated to follow, because the service that is being provided by EOH is automatically being transferred to the department.
I think the problem that we've had, at least from where I'm seated, is that you as officials, you see, don't start from a premise that says, or from a standpoint that says, as a department, we did not develop our own internal capacity in the 10 years that we've had the triple P. Now that it's coming to an end, we need the continuation of these services that we do not have. So we either go out on tender or we do a section 197. So we have a clear, I think for me, that would have been the simplest. So we cut through the fat and say, this is our challenge. This is the situation we find ourselves in. Because initially we were to go out on tender. Now the department decided, no, we're not going out on tender. And I think that's another critical point that we should have gone into. We're not longer going on tender because we think 1, 2, 3, 4. We're going on section 197 because we think these are the major advantages over going out on tender. I think that could have, for me, from where I'm seated, cleared the issues in less than no time. So that's what section 197 says. We're not going to change it. But why did we choose that route? Different from tendering, for example. Why did we not continue with the tender? CFO?
I think section 197 is not the choice of the department. What the section says is that when the department outsourced this IT services out to Siemens, at the end of the contract, we are obliged to reconsider those employees back into the department.
Where does the obligation come from? From the contract?
From the contract, yes.
No.
Okay.
It's not, it's a lie. I've got the contract.
See, if we're the annexure, then you would say, you see, in terms of annexure 7, section F, this is what it says. because the DG has indicated that we signed a contract that was skewed in favor of the company. And we appreciate it was signed in 2002. None of you sitting here was there. You can't explain the rationale of signing a contract that was prejudicial to the state, but that's what we have. So, but it also means that even on your side, when you decided you're going out on tender, your legal people had not gone with a fine comb, you know, over the contract and this annex to see the pitfall. Because then it means you actually might have gone out on tender and somebody takes you to court and they say, breach of contract. So, okay, comrade, so we know Section 197 is imposed on the department because of the contract signed in 2002.
Chair, I think we must correct that. They are saying it was imposed on them. We have to research that. They are saying that 197 was imposed on them. I think we have an obligation to research that particular aspect. Because there is a provision there when I looked at it. It said unless Section 7 applies.
Can we...
What is Section 7?
Can we go there?
And for me, Chair, it's too convenient that a contract signed in November 2002 that ends in October 2012, in September, October of the end of that contract, then another company comes and takes over.
Can we go back so we can... Is there such a thing as unless Section 7 applies somewhere? Just checking with the department. I mean, it's... we don't have them here. Subsection 7. Number 3. Yeah. Can we see subsection 7? What it says?
It's not a business. We're not buying a business. Are we buying shares?
Why don't we do this, comrades? I just want to... Why don't we do this? Have a copy of the contract and the annexes. 100-something pages. No, it's not... Not a mountain. You can give us hard copies. We'll make copies for our comrades. Not a big deal. And then we have a look at those elements. Firstly, that Section 197 is imposed on the department. And I'm sure that the Portfolio Committee should be able to take it up. But also appreciating that we're only left with 3 months. You know, whether the department did it deliberately to change course when there was limited time, say that... it becomes a case of there is no other option. Otherwise, everything is just going to collapse. Or what? I think for us, if we have those copies, I'm sure within a week we'd have gone through them and have a sense of what exactly is at stake, just to satisfy ourselves that indeed we have the correct information. Because the information is what we need. But I'm sure that our comrades in the Portfolio Committee who interact with the department on an ongoing basis can be able to take it up. Section 197, is it imposed from the contract or Is it an option that we have exercised out of our own free will as a department? And when you were out, DG, I asked the question. And I'm sure, I think the CO4 answered it, yeah. Why did we stop the tendering? And said, no, Section 197 is imposed on us by the contract. So I think for me those are the key points.
The clarity I want is just, is EOH a separate company which operate in the industry and has got other clients other than the department, or is just an institution which was created specifically for this particular project?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. EOH is or was an existing organization before taking buying over Siemens. So they have, I think they, in the top three ICT companies in South Africa. So they have been in existence and they've got a lot of other clients already.
Okay. Yes, you want to make a follow-up?
The question is that if EOH is an existing company separate, they were just running a particular project on behalf of the department, but these people remain their employees, whether the project is there or not, they still have got these employees. Why do we behave as if they are the staff which was operating within this particular project don't become their employees but have becomes a problem when this contract comes to an end? But that's questions which I will ask later also.
No,
but I just wanted clarity about
that. I think the CFO has answered that the contract signed in 2002 entailed that when the contract ends, Section 197 should apply. I'm not sure whether that section existed at that time or what, but that was the agreement in terms of what we're being told. Yes, honourable member.
Chairperson, may I also ask?
I want us to bring this to a close. Yeah.
We've always been told since I joined the Portfolio Committee on Labour that this contract was highly skewed against the department and in the favour of the private partner. Now, this contract speaks of open book accounting, which means that once a year the Siemens had to bring their books and to declare their expenditure in detail, their income, their profits even, etc. from this. But the CIO just referred and said, now that we've tested the market, it now seems to me as if we've underestimated the costs of ICT services in the open market, which then it just seems to me as if this agreement perhaps was not that skewed against the department, because now that we want to end this agreement, now we're discovering that actually ICT costs are far higher than what we're used to paying for ICT services. Can I just ask, is that what I heard from the CIO? Thank you.
I think from a cost perspective, I think the department benefited because we had a fixed cost for a 10-year period. And whereas ICT costs have been escalating every year or reducing every year, we knew what our budget was over the 10-year period. In terms of when the department says the contract was skewed, so let me give you one example. In terms of penalties, there was a maximum that the department valued of penalties that the department could impose on Siemens at the time. So that's just one example of how it was skewed on the side of the department, not in terms of costing itself.
I want us to bring this to a close. However, I see the five outstanding systems that the contract has come to an end, but these have not been delivered. We're left with about 3 months. These systems are not in place. So it either was a breach of contract from EOH, or once again it will be, we didn't have the capacity ourselves to have the system set up and run. But I'm sure those are issues that the portfolio committee congress can follow up. DG, let us thank you very much, because most often when we engage, there is a multiplicity of issues, and we hardly have time to focus on a key issue and go through it over time. And I think today's exercise has assisted us to have a sense and to appreciate that at least at long last, the department has developed its strategy in terms of where it wants to go, what it needs to do. Our only concern, of course, is the fact that it's like we're starting from scratch, and I think that's the fundamental problem that we, especially in the Public Accounts Committee, experience from time to time. Because unlike our comrades in the portfolio committees, who can engage, on a monthly or fortnightly basis with departments, by the time we engage, we find that certain things have not been there. Like, we're setting up things afresh. People who are before us cannot account for why certain decisions were taken or why certain omissions happened. But all of these impact on how the department functions. It has cost implications, and we can only hope for the future. And yet, our concern is more with what killed the patient, or actually who killed the patient, and if the person who killed the patient is not even there, it becomes a problem, you know, in terms of seeking accountability. But wish you the best of luck in the remaining 3 months to deal with these matters. We still intend to prioritize a compensation fund as soon as the annual reports hit Parliament. It is one of the entities that we would want to hang on to as we hit the last 100 meters of our lives as COPPA members. And then we'll see what happens. Comrades, thanks very much. Comrade Chair of the Portfolio Committee, I don't know if there's anything you would want to say before we bring this to a halt, to an end.
Thanks, Chairperson. Now, I must say that this was an eye-opener for us. The reason why we asked to be invited to this meeting is because we're going to deal with something very big that is bigger than us, and that we actually wanted to benefit from this collective thought between the experts in the SCOPA combined with ours. So we actually came here to learn and be influenced. So we have learned a lot, and that we are going to make a follow-up on some of the issues that you raised that I may not have been able to pick them during the presentation, and I thank you. And that next time when you meet with the committee, please keep us informed so that we can come and learn from you. But we'll again plead with the committee in our next meeting, with the department in the next meeting, that whenever they are making presentations anywhere in Parliament, they need to tell us about those presentations, because at the end, the final decision in terms of the presentation of what they present to us into Parliament can only be done by us and not SCOPA or any other person. So, DG. I think my message is loud and clear. It's a plea. And thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So, DG, we'll get the contract and the annexure. Let's have them as hard copies. We will be able to make copies ourselves. Well, the contract was signed in 2002 before EOH came into being, so you won't find EOH in the... Yeah, no, I think let's leave it at that. We'll get the contract, we'll look at them and see what we do. Thanks very much.
No, it's because no question in your email by voice and meeting for your community. So, what I have done is verify that information. I know, but my new committee all of it.
futhi ndicela ndibuza ikomiti ilabor izawudibana after this ongomso enkosibuti. Okay, buti.
The last one was difficult.
It wasn't easy.
this company hasn't been created as a result of the project, or is a company that exists.
Yeah. So if it's existing, it must take
it.
Must
head it.
It must be it.
It must be
oh shit. Thank you.
Let's have a boy. Let's go, let's have a boy. Let's go, let's have a boy. Okay.
We're going to be here.